The Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation has announced more than a dozen cases of COVID-19 related to the region. As case counts rise, agencies and individuals continue to look for ways to keep our community safe. Anna Hoffman is the co-chair of the Alaska Federation of Natives and a Bethel community member. She has been listening to people's questions locally and presented them to Alaska's chief medical officer, Dr. Ann Zink, and to YKHC chief of staff, Dr. Ellen Hodges. KYUK is broadcasting the interview as a public service, which was recorded yesterday morning.
Thank you, Anna Rose and KYUK, for inviting us to participate and share some information with the listening audience today. Over the last several months, the governor's office has reached out to representatives from AFN, including myself, to understand how communities are coping with the pandemic and how communications can be strengthened. These questions are presented in hopes of enhancing our overall understanding of the situation at hand and continuing to work with one another to stay safe and healthy. I'll start out with a phrase that we've been hearing a lot in this area, the notion of a false positive. Is there such a thing as a false positive? And if so, what does that mean? Dr. Zink?
Thank you so much, Anna, and thank you for having me on here and for all the people in the region listening in and learning so much about COVID and the science of it. I get asked that question a lot. Is there such a thing as a false positive or a false negative? All of these tests have limitations, like any test that we do. Any test that we do, a blood work or a flu test, all of them have limitations. Right now, as a state, we are not taking a positive and saying it's necessarily a false positive because the risk of missing a true disease is really important. So every positive we take is a potential real positive, and we investigate to try to figure out what that looks like. It may be that someone is at the end of their disease, and so additional tests afterwards may turn up negative. There can be problems in the collection. So if the sample was accidentally contaminated in the process or some other component, we always look through that process and make sure that there was no break in the chain. Because what goes from the virus in someone's nose to the swab, to the machine, and to the result, there's a lot of parts in that system that things can potentially break down. And so if someone's symptoms are not consistent with the test results, we kind of go back through that chain, repeat the test, and see where else they're at. And most of the time, what we're finding is when a test is initially positive and then repeat tests afterwards are negative, it's likely that they're end of their viral process. So they were kind of finishing up on their disease course and they had very mild symptoms previously and are finishing up. But we want to take every one of these positives, take them seriously and go through them and make sure that we take that into consideration.
Thank you, Dr. Zink. We've had positive cases in this area, and YKHC has been very diligent about getting out into the various communities and providing wide-range testing. Can you describe the type of testing that occurs? We heard a little bit about it from Dr. Zink, but can you elaborate on that, Dr. Hodges? And if a rapid test result is negative, should a person consider themselves safe? Dr. Hodges?
Thank you, Anna. And again, I'll repeat what Dr. Zink said. It's an honor to be on here. And thank you to everyone out there who's listening to this show and learning about COVID and the YK Delta. So when we respond out to a village, we usually send a team that has both a rapid ID now tester and collections kits that can be sent off for send out testing. So what we do is we rapid test the people who we need to test right away and have an answer right away. So that would be anyone who's in very close contact with a person who's tested positive, anyone in the village who has symptoms or has a high risk health condition that we would make a big difference if we knew if they were positive right away or not. And when we test general members of the community, we generally speaking collect tests that are sent out. So we do kind of a combination of both of those tests when we're in a village. When we get a rapid result that is negative, we advise the person who's been tested that they still need to stay in quarantine. This doesn't eliminate the need for quarantine. The rapid test, we do feel reassured by the rapid test that they're negative right at that point in time. But often in these case investigations, we have reasons to test them additional times in their quarantine period. So sometimes people feel like, oh, my rapid test is negative, or even my send-out test is negative, and now I'm okay to kind of mix with the community. But we really strongly advise people to remain in quarantine for the length of period of time that the public health officials have advised.
Okay, that leads right into my next question. Since the pandemic has started, I've heard a variety of different quarantine times, from 5 days to 2 weeks to longer. And as we're seeing increased testing, the quarantine times feel like they've changed. Are there recommended times depending upon waiting for test results, or what is the recommended quarantine time that we should be adhering to? Dr. Zink?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So much has changed, and we're all learning and trying to follow the science as closely as possible. As Dr. Hodges mentioned, a test is a point in time. It just says, do you have the virus in your nose at that moment in time? But it doesn't look at the whole picture of that patient. What we know is that a quarantine, a 14-day quarantine, is the safest option. And the reason for that is because this disease can take a really long time to show up. And if someone develops symptoms, even very mild symptoms during that 14-day period, that's the time that's most useful to use the test to get tested. So if we're going to use our resources most efficiently, it's a 14-day quarantine period, and at any sign of new symptoms, get tested during that period. For people who are working in congregate settings or high-risk areas, sometimes we'll add a test at the end of the 14-day quarantine period. That's kind of your most safe way of doing it. So that 14 days, someone's totally asymptomatic, and test at the end of that. 14 days is a long time, and it's a big disturbance to your life and to your family. And for critical infrastructure workers, sometimes they can't, you know, work and be able to do that. And so we're always trying to come up with ways to kind of shorten it, but those ways come with risks. And so the more you shorten your quarantine, and the higher the risk you are. And that's why a 5-day with a test is going to be slightly riskier than a 7-day with a test, which is riskier than 14-day with a test. And so it's a series of kind of stepwise processes along those lines. We do have all sorts of protocols that we're working with the fishing industry and critical infrastructure on ways to use test and quarantine to minimize the risk. But again, that is trying to assess the risk of the disease transferring to another person, the risk of the disease to that individual person, as well as what can be done. So again, so we highly recommend, just as Dr. Hodges recommended, if you're asked to do a 14-day quarantine, that you please do that 14-day quarantine, particularly if you've been exposed to someone who's been COVID positive, because it's the safest way to protect your family, to your community, is to go ahead and do that. The testing at the airport and other testing, I get asked that question all the time, how come it's different there than it's testing and other aspects? Again, we look at what we call the pretest probability, or the chance that you have the disease. A test prior to someone coming into state, we see as kind of a point in time, just a sense if they have the disease. And then we ask people to watch their window or minimize their interactions for 7 to 14 days afterwards and get a test near the end of it. Again, that's to add a test in combination with that quarantine period to minimize that risk of spread to other people. So it's a layered approach. And in general, that quarantine with the test at the end is the safest and why we recommend it in most cases.
Okay, that's very helpful. Thank you, Dr. Zink. So a 14-day quarantine is the best recommendation, it sounds like, from the description you gave. And it is just a matter of reducing risk. And so the safest approach would be the 14 days. Now, when we talk about quarantine, we also hear about self-isolation. How do you define quarantining? And we can start with Dr. Zink again.
That's a great question. So the way I remember it is isolation, it goes with illness. So I and I. So if you're sick or if you've tested positive, then you need to be in isolation from others. Quarantine is for someone who is not sick, but is at risk for developing the disease. And so it's someone who may have recently traveled or been a close contact to someone else. And so that's the difference between quarantine and isolation. They do get used interchangeably a lot. For many practical purposes, they're very similar. It's stay away from others and be in your own. So from a practical standpoint, they're very, very similar in sense. But we use the term isolation for illness. Someone is positive for the disease, and we need to isolate that person who has the disease from their loved ones, from their community, to make sure that they don't accidentally spread it. This disease is incredibly contagious. And I saw a meme the other day that described it as glitter at a craft party. It can just attach to everything. And so you're in an indoor space, people can get it just really, really quickly. And so that's why we want to keep that glitter all together. We want to isolate people who are sick and keep that virus from shedding to others, versus quarantine is keeping you in a separate room and away from that person and others to watch and see if you develop those symptoms.
Okay, that's super helpful. Thank you. And Dr. Hodges, this will be... you can elaborate more on the quarantine and isolation, and also this term lockdown, which we've been hearing in the YK Delta. And we heard that also in reference to the term community spread. So as COVID cases continue to rise in Alaska, I expect we'll hear the reference to community spread more and more. how and who determines if there is a likelihood of community spread? And then what? How do you envision what lockdown for a community means?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Anna. Thank you. And I think community spread, generally speaking, means that you have people who have tested positive for the disease in a particular region that don't have a history of travel out of that area, and they don't have any connection to any other positive cases. And that's usually what we mean when we talk about community spread. And the reason why this is important is because it's possible then that other people in that community without knowing could be positive. And so we wanna make especially clear in this area with limited healthcare resources and limited abilities to isolate themselves from other members of the community are aware that there might possibly be the chance to pick up the virus while being out in the community rather than just being in contact with a sick person or traveling to an area where there might be a lot of positive cases. And I think the village lockdown is sort of a little bit like a hunker down or a shelter in place. And I think that is a really good way to kind of look at it, asking people to sort of stay in their houses and not mix a lot with the community and to limit their trips to the grocery store and their interactions with non-household members. And in some of our villages, that's really hard to do because households are very large and family groups are very large and social. And so we often say social distancing, and I like to say physical distancing. Like, you don't have to be socially isolated from your family. You just have to stay away from them, just stay 6 feet away from them and wear a mask if you can't stay 6 feet away. And so I think that's a really important point to mention. And I do really compliment all of the villages who have been able to successfully ask their communities to do this when they have been notified of a case, because that's useful for us from an epidemiological perspective to limit the spread in some of these villages.
Okay, great. Yes, thank you. And I also commend our communities because there really has been a very proactive response when we hear about a positive case in the community. As we navigate through this time, and you just mentioned this here, Dr. Hodges, about face masking. As we navigate through this time, we want to encourage respectful interactions with our friends and neighbors. How does wearing a face mask help? And what else can we do? Keep track of who we're interacting with? How does knowing who we're contacting or interacting with help in this whole scenario? Dr. Zink?
Yeah, so great question, Anna. I appreciate that. And to build a little bit also on Dr. Hodges' comment on community spread, I just wanted to mention that, you know, from a U.S. standpoint, I remember the moment in the day when we first had our first community case in Northern California. I was at a meeting in Washington, D.C., because that was a big trigger. That was something that was very different than travel-associated cases, because just as Dr. Hodges mentioned, it meant it was circulating and we didn't know where and we didn't know how. And so suddenly we were going to have a very different response. And so the entire federal response changed there. The same thing happened at the state. Our first case was a cargo pilot. But the first time we had a community case, that's when we started to have the mandates and we started to change our response, because it's a very different scenario when you have a community case versus when you have a travel associated case. That's part of the reason why, again, with the seafood workers, a lot of our out-of-state workers, all of them are in quarantine to try to keep them from having a community spread. And that's why all of this kind of teamwork together is really important. And that goes exactly to what you mentioned there. What can we do? So hand washing is still really important. Like, I don't want to forget that in the process. This virus is fascinating. It's a little tiny packet of information surrounded by a little shell of lipids, of kind of fatty protein that protects it. And so soap and water breaks that apart and completely destroys the virus on the inside. And so soap and water is amazing. And so is alcohol-based hand sanitizer. So I can't emphasize that enough. The role of masks has been changing significantly. Initially, you know, we know that we cover our nose and our mouth when we sneeze or we cough. It's part of our culture for all sorts of good reasons and to prevent spread of disease. But what we have really learned about this disease is that these micro droplets, these small droplets of particles, contain the virus. And just from singing or talking, and particularly being in indoor spaces, we can easily transfer it from one person to another. That's particularly when you're within 6 feet, particularly when you're indoors, particularly when you're projecting your voice, singing, coughing. Those things make a really big difference with the disease. We actually have very few outbreaks associated with outdoor gatherings. And so that's why right now we're like, get outside, be outside as much as possible. It makes me worried about the fall and the winter when it's much harder to be outside in general. But the role of a mask at two different things, one, making sure you don't spread it, but then also some protection for yourself, are becoming increasingly clear. And so a well-woven cloth face covering, our face mask, does a really good job of what we call source control, keeping that virus from spreading from you to someone else. What's so challenging about this disease is that many people have very, very mild symptoms and they feel completely well. And what we find in our case investigation is they'll test positive for, let's say they traveled or pre-procedure. And then we go through their history, they think, oh, that runny nose, I just thought was allergies, or I just thought that I was just fatigued that past week. And many people do get very sick, but many people have very mild symptoms. And so the test is the only way to know. And as a result, I think we really need to assume that everyone has COVID these days, that we are all transmitting it, that I'm transmitting it to my computer right now as it's sitting here. Fortunately, my computer can't get it. But that's why I wear a face covering when I'm around other people. We are seeing again and again across many countries and many states that when the majority of people wear a face covering, that we don't get into this exponential climb, that we may have contacts within a household who get it, but we don't see it spread rapidly amongst the community. And so again, like the glitter analogy, it's like putting a lid on it. There may be a few that sneak out there, but it really kind of puts a lid on it and keeps it spreading to other people.
Okay. And then the contacts.
Oh, yes.
I think that's an important one as well.
Uh-huh. It is an important one. Thank you. There's been so many questions about masks recently that I dove right into that one. Yeah, contacts is a big deal. So again, how many people you interact with, how we define a close contact per CDC is 15 minutes or more within 6 feet of someone. So it's a pretty small interaction, and that can even be cumulative. So say a waitress at a restaurant is interacting with someone back and forth. It can be a cumulative 15 minutes. So not just a point in time. And that's hard to minimize that amount of interaction in a lot of our daily lives. The more that you can keep that circle small, the better off we are at being able to not have the virus rapidly spread. Again, I think as humans, we think very much in terms of linear terms, but what can happen with this disease is it can grow exponentially. If I give it to two other people and they give it to two other and they give it to two other, suddenly we have this exponential growth and it can very quickly overwhelm our healthcare system. There are a bunch of online forms where you can keep track of the number of people that you contact. Another tool I often say is if you can't name everyone that you've come in contact with in the last week, you've been seeing too many people. And so what ways you can pull that back so you should be able to name everyone that you're in contact with. There's apps that can help you do it. You can put a calendar on your wall and you can do it. You can download the forms that we have on the state website and do it. Other things to think about is to spread out your work. So maybe you go to the store 1 week and then you visit someone the following week or 2 weeks later. Or if you need to travel to Anchorage to get supplies and to get food, you do that. Or you need to travel to Bethel, you do that 1 week and you minimize your interactions for the 2 weeks after that. So again, giving people the tools to know that quarantining helps, spreading out those interactions and limiting those circles as much as possible makes a big difference in not spreading it to our loved ones and our communities around us.
Okay, great. And that's our homework assignment for everybody that's listening in. Take a moment to think about who it is that you interacted with over the last week. And if you can name them all, then you get an A+. If you can't name them all, then we should think about who we're interacting with more and make sure we keep track of that. Because when there is a positive case, there's the work of contact tracing. And knowing who you have been in contact with will be super helpful to our healthcare workers in containing that spread and being most informed. YKHC serves 56 communities. What should we be most proud of here and in our area in response to COVID? And what can we improve upon from your perspective? Dr. Hodges?
Well, thank you, Anna. I think we have a lot to be proud of. I think I'll start with testing. We have a high participation in our volunteer testing, both at the airport and when we have people who are around in either our communities or in our villages who have symptoms, there's no hesitation. People will agree to a test. And we also have really high participation in our contact tracing and working with some of our coworkers who had to do this testing statewide. They have reported maybe there's some trouble with that, and we don't have any problems with contact tracing here. People are, they talk to us about who they were around. They're very honest. And I think in every single case, they've reached back and been like, oh, I thought of this one person. I want to make sure you got this person on your list. And just being very conscientious about making sure that we know everyone that they were around, even if it was just like a pass by on the street or on the boardwalk. So I'm really proud of all of our patients who have had to go through that, and then their family members too. I think quarantining together as a family, because isolating the sick person from the household is really hard. And so our families that have to kind of sacrifice and quarantine together doing that. And the communities that step up and support these families is also amazing. I like to call that the COVID kindness in our region, where they reach out and they provide the services that they need. You know, if they need to go to the post office to pick up their mail, or if they need groceries, or they need something dropped off, or some tasks done, the communities have really been very supportive and very reaching out. And I also, again, can't say enough about how great our villages have been, and our tribal councils and our city governments, and being proactive to work with us and to work with public health officials to really keep their communities safe. And they ask really good, tough, smart questions. They challenge us and they encourage us, and we all kind of work together. And that's just been really, it's really been wonderful. It's been insightful. It's been a growth for all of us. And I think as far as what we can improve on, I think for all of us here, improving our social circles. This is a very social community and a social culture, and so trying to limit your social circles, it's really hard to do. And I know that, and I have trouble myself. I'm also very social. I was laughing. I was saying, if I ever have to leave this region and go back into quarantine, I'm going to have to go camping by myself somewhere, because it's hard for me not to be around other people, and to make sure that we can keep our loved ones safe. And I think all of us could do a little bit better on that. And there's so many changing initiatives coming from the state, coming from the CDC, coming from YK. And I think keeping up on all of that is something we could always do better on and be improved on, and just making sure that we're communicating the change of it. It's really hard. There's so many changing things in this pandemic. Things we knew to be true a month ago are just no longer true. And I think that's confusing, and just trying to make sure we get that communicated in the simplest and best way we can for our communities.
Okay, great. Yes. And so it's to stay vigilant and not be complacent, and continuing to stay informed as best we can. And KYUK is helping us with that aspect of it here today. The last question I have is, how has the COVID experience in the YK Delta been either similar to or unique from the rest of the state? And we heard about that a little bit with Dr. Hodge's response, but I wanted to get your perspective on this question here, Dr. Zink.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that question, Anna. And I would agree with Dr. Hodges. I mean, these are honestly my favorite calls, and particularly when we get call-ins from village leaders and tribal leaders and communities and hear what it's like. The hard questions are super important. And the YK region from the beginning has actually stood out being able to get community health aides to do testing and education, making sure that there isn't stigma associated with COVID. I think it's just really, really important. There's no shame in COVID. It's a disease. It's highly contagious. And we all have to work together to get tested early to minimize the spread of the disease. I think that the resiliency is the other thing that I just really see again and again, and people working together across all different walks of life and in different communities, from local to kind of the hub all the way to the state and to federal government. I think it's been inspiring to see. I call Dr. Hodges probably more times than she wants to say, what does this look like on your end? Help me understand this. Is this going to work or is this not going to work? And I think the engagement, the YK region is a region that I go to often to run ideas past, to get input and feedback on what this looks like from a rural perspective, to make sure that what we're doing makes sense or doesn't make sense, and to get feedback. And so I really appreciate the community's partnership and hope to continue that. I think we're going to have to dig deep in our resilience pools come fall and winter. We have more cases, and finding ways to be connected and resilient now, and finding ways to make this, as you've mentioned before, our new normal and normal mm-hmm. is going to be really, really important to be able to be resilient through the fall and winter to make sure that we've got really good outcomes associated with this worldwide pandemic.
Yes, that's a very good point. It's not something we're going to have to relax anytime soon. This normal that we're experiencing now is going to be our experience for the coming future. It could be for another year that we are dealing with this, and the strength that we're gathering from our communities now is going to sustain us through that time period. That concludes the questions I have. I wanted to provide you both an opportunity to make any closing comments, and we'll start with Dr. Hodges.
Oh, great. Thank you, Anna, so much. And I think probably my most closing comment is to just thank everyone who's listening for their participation in this. I've always said this is not something that one entity or one person can even hope to control. We need everyone's full participation in protecting the communities out here, especially because of our fragile medical system. And I just really appreciate the input from everyone to do that. This is by no means over. We're seeing a lot of increases in cases, both in our region and statewide, and just asking people to just remain vigilant and to realize, just like Anna said, this isn't over. And we're kind of in the middle of a new normal, and to get used to it and to just support and protect the communities as best you can, and continue to do and follow the recommendations that the public health officials in our area have made.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Hodges. Dr. Zink?
Yes, thank you, Anna, and thank you to everyone who's listening and to radio for putting this on, and Dr. Hodges for all of your partnership and help. I agree with many of the things that were said. I'm done with COVID. It's annoying. We all want to be over it, but it's still here. And unfortunately, it very much sets the timetable and not us. And there are these tools that, while are simple to understand, can be hard to implement, but they are very, very powerful tools. I really want to end on a message of hope. It's been phenomenal to see, you know, healthcare facilities who care for hundreds of COVID patients never have a single one of their healthcare providers get it, because they wash their hands, they wear a mask, they, you know, socially distance, they don't share lunch break all in the same room. So we have tools, we have ways to control this, we have ways to write our future, but it is going to take, just as Dr. Hodges said, every single one of us to have the power to control this disease and to minimize the spread. COVID can only live in people when we give it a chance to. And so if we keep ourselves apart and we keep from spreading to each other, it can't live. And we really have control over that. And so I really appreciate everyone's patience and resiliency, and Alaskans working together. And also, I just want to end by saying we're in this together. I sometimes look at these contact tracing, and it's like seeing this like secret web of how we're all just so interconnected that we may not see otherwise. But one case, 100 cases, 1,000 cases, we are all in this together from a state, from a federal perspective, local perspective. We will continue to figure this out together because we're so much stronger together. Thank you.
Thank you, Brianna, for taking the time to have this discussion with us today. I'm Anna Hoffman. I'm the co-chair of the Alaska Federation of Natives, and I hope the conversation has been helpful to the KYUK listeners. This is a challenging time, but as Alaskans, we are resilient and we have a strong tradition of helping and supporting one another. Let's keep that in mind as we move forward. Hoyana, Dr. Zink, Hoyana, Dr. Hodges, Doing Unredok Birchi.